Well, it's our final hour here of phone calls with our guest, Russell Gold, his book, The Boom, as we talk about fracking here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back with Russell Gold here. Russell, so in your book, The Boom, did you come to any specific conclusions about fracking?
Well, one of the things I really came and made the argument for was that we need to slow down a little. We're moving so fast, and the boom occurred so quickly that a lot of things were left behind, and a lot of questions were left unanswered. And there's absolutely no way that if we want this to continue, if we want to really get the benefits of this, we need to slow down a little. I mean, one of the perfect examples of that was in North Dakota.
One more hour to go, Russell. Push yourself.
Well, it's just, North Carolina, North Dakota, we'll figure it out. The North Dakota grew so quickly that they didn't have enough pipeline. So they start venting off and flaring off natural gas, which is a waste of a perfectly good fuel.
Right.
And then they put the oil, since they didn't have enough oil pipelines, they put it on trains. Well, it turned out that the oil was really volatile, and some of these trains were getting into accidents and having absolutely enormous explosions. And,
oh, God.
All of this was foreseeable. I shouldn't say it was foreseeable, but in retrospect, we look at it and say, okay, here's a problem. And this all came because we were moving so quickly that decisions were being made, and it was just sort of getting, put together with a little bit of bailing, bubble gum and bailing wire. And I think if we slow down a little and make sure that we're doing things right, then we'll all be a lot happier with how this energy boom is going, because we don't want to look back in 20 years and say, oh man, we messed this up. We had such a golden opportunity and we didn't take advantage of it, or we did something wrong. And I think that's kind of important.
How much of it is just plain old common sense? And that is, we need energy. We got to make it work. Let's use it the best way we can.
I think there's a lot of common sense here. And I find myself often just saying, well, here's a common sense solution. How about this as a common sense solution? Hmm. So I completely agree with that. But look, common sense and energy have not always seen eye to eye. And one of the things you have to that I always remind myself is that we use so much energy, and there's so much need for that energy that the industry comes up with some pretty remarkable solutions to it. It's not that the industry's out there sort of generating all this energy and then trying to sell it to us. We want this energy. We take everything that they give us, and we can look at the industry and say, well, that maybe they're cutting corners here, or there's something wrong here, but they're doing it often, well, they're doing it in the name of profit, but they're also doing it in the name of supplying a need. And one of the great stories I uncovered in working on this book, which I didn't realize before, was that in the 1960s, we started running a little low on natural gas. And so one of the ideas was, well, maybe we could try fracking, but we try fracking with nuclear bombs. And, when I tell people this, they say, well, what a crazy idea. We didn't actually try to do that. I said, well, sure we did. Back in the late 60s and early 70s, there was a series of tests out west and New Mexico and then Colorado, where we actually put nuclear bombs down wells and exploded the nuclear bomb as a way to fracture the wells to see what we could get out. This is there's a lot of ingenuity in this industry. Sometimes it heads off in a slightly odd direction, but it's all in the name of providing the energy that we as Americans in the world want and need.
After they obliterated the wells with the nukes, what was left?
Well, they tried to create, it's interesting. They actually got gas out of these wells. The problem was, as you can imagine, the gas that was laced with radioactive tritium and other radioactive elements. And there was one great study. I always like this. They did a study and they said, well, okay, so there's some radioactivity in this gas, but if we put the gas into the pipelines, where would this gas go, and how much of a dose would people get? Would any towns get too high a dose? And they figured out that the two towns that would get the highest dose of radioactive gas coming through, where they heat their homes with and the cooking and cook with, the two towns were Rifle, Colorado, and Aspen, Colorado. So can you imagine Aspen? you know, the fuss that would have been raised there.
Oh, huge.
But there's another kind of interesting twist in historical twist here, which is that they kept getting bigger and bigger. They kept using bigger and bigger bombs. You know, the first bomb was relatively small in Farmingham, New Mexico, and then they moved up into Colorado and they tried slightly larger bombs. They kept thinking, well, maybe if we just go bigger, that this will work out. And so they had this plan in the early 70s, it was Project Wagon Wheel, and they were going to detonate a series of bombs in Wyoming, and that was going to create a large fracture field, lots of gas was going to come out of it. The local congressman said, no, you know, this is, you're not making sense anymore, this is not going to work, and he cut funding for it. And it was a real contentious fight, and after a couple years later, he announced that he was retiring, and it created an open seat, and that paved the way for Dick Cheney to enter politics.
Oh, boy.
He took over, and that was his entry. That was how he began.
Let's go to the phones. Chuck's in Indianapolis. Get us going here, Chuck. Go ahead.
Hi, George. Russell. One thing that they haven't worked on for renewable energy are our oceans, the movement of our waters in the oceans. We're surrounded by an area that could provide all types of energy from that movement of that ocean, and they haven't done it. They've talked about it 40, 50 years ago, did nothing about it. And as for taking oil out of our earth, it's making our earth wobble as we travel around the sun. It's like taking water out of a ball and rolling it. It wobbles now. It doesn't go up and down on the axis any longer. And as we do, our Arctic and Antarctic is closer to the sun and melting our ice caps. Now, talk about common sense. Where is it? Thank you, Russell.
Well, Russell, are we taking out enough?
Things about, what was that?
Are we taking out enough to make the planet wobble?
Well, I was going to say, it's one of the great things about this show is that, you know, you learn something new, or at least you hear about a theory you hadn't heard of before. I don't know. That's not something I'd heard of. I'm just smart enough to realize I'm not smart enough to know whether he's right or not. It's not something I've encountered, though.
What do you think? What do you think about taking out? Do we create earthquakes with fracking?
Well, that's a great question. You know, the first thing, yeah, we do. That's a simple answer.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, we clearly, there's no question that we create earthquakes with disposal wells. You take all this water out. The water's got some, impurities.
Yeah.
Some of it you can clean up, but most of it is injected underground. And what we started to do is basically we're injecting so much water that we were lubricating some existing faults. These were earthquakes that were going to happen sometime in the future. We sped up the process. We knew that. And then a week ago, scientifically, we know that. That's not really an argument anymore. A week ago, Ohio came out and said, just last Friday, we believe that fracking itself has caused a series of small earthquakes near Poland, Ohio. They're not 100%. There's some controversy involved here. Not everyone agrees, but so now we're having this discussion. Does fracking itself cause earthquakes? Maybe it does.
Let's go to Tim in Prudhoe Bay, Alaska. Hey, Tim, go ahead.
Hey, George Russell. First of all, I wanted to say it's kind of interesting. I'm calling you from Prudhoe. There's not an AM station up here that actually broadcasts this show. So I'm listening to you on an Anchorage station as it bounces off the ionosphere. So it's
That's
coming
right.
up from Anchorage, hitting the atmosphere, and hitting us all the way up here in the very northern tip of Alaska. So kind of a neat little fact maybe the coast-to-coast listeners would like. But I was curious about, I think for a lot of people, the first time that they'd heard of fracking was the that Gasland documentary. And, of course, yeah. I'm sure you're familiar with it and how it portrays fracking and the topside effects that it has. You know, beyond, spilling 2 gallons of diesel on the soil and, putting duck ponds underneath vehicles, some of the large scale, like watershed and things like that, those effects, you know, they did a pretty convincing portrayal. You know, it seems like that's really happening, you know, out there in Pennsylvania and North Dakota. And I was wondering if there had been any studies or if you knew of anything as to what was causing that, like if they're even certain the relationship that fracking has with some of the larger scale features, the broad stroke, like watershed type stuff. Fracking is becoming more and more prevalent in the world, and I know that they're talking about using more of it in Alaska, especially down in the Cook Inlet area, which has seen declining production. Economically, people are pretty excited about it. It's going to be a boom, but in the back of my mind, I'm wondering if they're even thinking about some of the broad stroke issues that you're seeing back there, back east. We're going to see those here.
Well, you know, a couple thoughts about what you said. You know, you raised Gasland. People forget that Gasland is first shown on HBO right in the middle of the Deepwater Horizon spill. And this was a period in the summer, late spring, early summer of 2010, when they had when that gushing well was on cable TV, right at the bottom of every channel you watched. I mean, this was a period where the public was primed to distrust anything that the oil and gas industry was doing. And then all of a sudden you've got this documentary which is claiming that people were lighting their faucets on fire. So, you know, it was well-timed, let's say. Here's what I say about water tables. There have been instances where poorly built wells have caused contamination of aquifers. And some problems. It is not rampant. It's not everywhere. The industry's track record has been fairly good, but it can get better. But this is not widespread environmental destruction that some would have you believe. That's not what I've seen, and that's not what the scientific work and the studies have shown. So I'm a little leery of that. I don't want to say everything's perfect. I don't want to paint too rosy a picture, but I think that the industry, by and large, can do it right. And as long as people and the regulators remain vigilant, they will.
Russell, while you were researching the book, The Boom, did you come across anything that surprised you, shocked you, baffled you?
Using a nuclear bomb to blow stuff up, that kind of, you know, to frack, that sort of surprised me. I wasn't expecting that. You know, I was very surprised. I talked a little about George Mitchell and creating fracking, and
yeah.
I came across, you know, I live in Texas. It's not known as being the most, the strongest regulatory state, but they did there were some complaints about water wells in North Texas, and they went out there and they did an investigation, and they found that he had short-cased some of the wells. He hadn't put enough cement in. That really surprised me. That was something I had not expected or seen coming. And, you know, it just goes to show that, that the industry is, you know, you need to keep an eye on it. We all need to remain vigilant. If we're going to use energy, we got to keep an eye on what's going on. And that surprised me. I didn't realize that had happened. And, you know, the state of Texas, issued the largest fine ever, and you know, this is all something that was sort of lost, even though it was only 20 years ago, people had forgotten about it.
All right, next up, let's go to Toledo, Ohio. Scott's with us. Scott apparently works in the fracking business. Hey, Scott, go ahead.
Hi, how you doing, George?
Good, Scott. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, I was down in the Carlsbad, New Mexico area. Actually, I hauled the oil out of the oil fields. I trucked it out on the trucks, and it's true. They do have containment areas. They're rubber lined that they fit the tanks down inside of, so there's no contamination, you know, or very little to the environment. But, you know, I talked to the flowback, which is the man that sets the wells up when they get done putting all the slurry, which is the water and sand mixture, down into the well itself. the wells down in New Mexico, they use high-pressure air compressors. They have to truck them in on semis. And they put pressure down into the well, which the water comes out mainly first. And you get a lot of water out at the very first. And then as the water slowly, you get most of it out at the beginning, then the oil comes out mainly towards the end, and then your well really produces a lot of oil towards the end. And to my understanding is the wells are so deep down in the ground that they're well below the water tables. You know, your water tables that you get your drinking water out of is much shallower than the oil down in the earth. And I know from some of the oil that I had, it was as clear as paint thinner. You wouldn't believe how clean it was. It was actually, we called it condensate.
It was like it was already refined, huh?
Yeah, it was so clean. It was almost like paint thinner. It would evaporate off your gauge before you could even get it up out of the tank.
Yeah.
And, you know, if there was, in my opinion, any chance of contamination into the water table, the product that's down in the ground would already be in the water. And I didn't personally feel that. Yeah, I know that, and like your guest said, there is still things they need to figure out on all this. But to me, I think it's a great thing to get every drop out, especially when there's product down in the ground to that magnitude, you know, that's that clean and that flammable that's down in there. You know, to get it out of the earth itself and then to use it if we can.
What do you think of that, Scott? It's exactly what you've been saying.
Well, you know, your caller's absolutely right. A lot of this oil that's coming out is just incredibly high quality. It's practically gasoline. You have to refine it, but, man, you don't have to do much to it. So, you know, he's absolutely right. Look, we've created this entire new industry, and a very large one, the span of a few years. Of course there are going to be issues. Of course things need to be ironed out. That's really what we need. You know, look, we're having this argument, should we be fracking or not fracking? The fact of the matter is, we're fracking 100 wells a day in the United States.
And we've been doing it apparently for years.
And we've been doing it for several years. So, I mean, really, I think it makes a lot more sense to sit down and have this argument or have a discussion. Let's not even have an argument. Let's have a discussion about how much, you know, what can we do to make sure it's better? You know, a bunch of callers that have mentioned the duck ponds, right, which are the liners you put under trucks to make sure that
right,
if there is a leak, it's captured. You know, that's a pretty common sense thing to do. I mean, let's figure other stuff out. Let's use brackish water, you know, instead of fresh water for fracking. There's lots of different stuff we could do. And
Russell, we're going to come back and take final phone calls with you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, on our next Coast to Coast program, split show for you. First couple hours, Craig Hewlett joins us talking about world events. Will there be a World War III? And then later on, we'll be communicating with the angels. So make sure you're part of that program. Welcome back to Coast. Russell Gold with us, The Boom. It's an incredible book, a great read, by the way. Are you finding that certain regions of the country, Russell, are buying the book more than others?
You know, the book's only been out for about 8 or 9 days, and I don't have that data yet. I'm interested in it. I'm curious whether, you know, Houston is a big market for me or shale areas. Well, we'll see. But I just don't have that yet.
Well, you'll get more and more exposure, that's for sure, and it is well done. Now, and when do you put the Wall Street Journal hat back on? Immediately?
I kind of have it on already. I've got a couple stories that are going to come out early next week, so I'm wearing a lot of hats right now. I'm doing a lot of juggling, but you know what? It's all good.
I'll try to talk with you just for a bit about the Deep Horizon before we get off the air here. Let's go to Don in Weed, California, west of the Rockies. Donald, go ahead.
George, hi, Russell. Hey, kind of on the subject of the pollution, George, wasn't there a guest on Coast a while ago that said something to the extent that
The volcanoes of the planet put out more CO2s in a month than what we did in like 40 years.
Yep, sure does.
I guess I was the only one that's seen it, but at late night a few years ago, I seen an episode of Nova on Discovery, and they were talking, it was about the continental plates and how they shifted and got where they are and broke off and moved here and there. But about the middle of this show, they went into this explanation of how everything that dies off in the oceans ends up at the base of these continental plates where the ocean meets land, where for years and years it just churns and churns and gets made into a tar oil, where then the pressures of the oceans push it into the land. And, so ever since I've seen that, I've been with you, George, on the renewability of it. And for 27 years, I've been passing this oil pump down on I-5 in 99 at the bottom of the Grapevine, and it's all rusted out. I've never seen it moving in 27 years. And about 3 months ago, I went by it, and by God, it was pumping. And
we'll do that for you.
And I did a little flatbedding here a little while ago, and I delivered some crane parts up into the middle of Wyoming, up out in the middle of nowhere. And I asked, it was to an oil well, and I asked the guy what they were doing, and he said that they were an outside company that comes in and makes a deal with these owners of these old oil wells that are basically, they can't pump nothing out of them no more. And he says they drill a elevator shaft right down next to it, go underneath of it, and drill holes up through the bottom. And he said that, and I asked him, I says, well, you know, what kind of a production, what's in it for you guys? And, how much could you possibly get out of what he explained to me, that it was a lot like a milkshake, where basically for years and years they pumped all the liquid stuff around, and when it gets to the big thick stuff in the middle, they can't pump it. So he says what's the profits on that? And he says, well, we're going to put 100 holes right up into the bottom of this well. And I says, so how much are you going to get? He says, about 100 barrels a day. And I said, well, for how long? He says, we estimate about 20 years.
Wow. What a good return from a dead well.
Yeah. And, that's about it.
Well, that's been the history of the oil industry, is that they drill the well, and this is true for shale as well. You drill the well, and maybe you get 10 or 15% of the oil and gas out of the rock first time around. And then you find out, you figure out a new way to get a little bit more, and a little bit more, and a little bit more. And, you go to a place like Bakersfield, California, where they've been drilling and pumping oil for 100 years, and it's amazing how much oil they eventually get out. I mean, you never quite get 100% out, but they start maybe with 5 or 10%. By the time they're done, they've gotten maybe 80% of the oil out. It's pretty remarkable.
Are the energy companies responsible in terms of drilling, or are they irresponsible?
Well, that's a great question, and that's the question we got to be asking ourselves all the time. Because on the one hand, you think to yourself, well, surely these guys are responsible. It's in their own best interest. But then you look at the Deepwater Horizon. I mean, and that took one of the biggest companies in the world and just, it just laid it out. I mean, I'm not sure if long-term BP ultimately survives this. And that was that was clearly irresponsible. So, the good news with shale is that the wells are smaller and they're a lot less... there's a lot less risk involved, and they're up on the surface. They're not under 5,000 feet of water. They're a lot easier to get to if something goes wrong. But, to answer your question, the big companies are responsible. They've got a lot at stake. They've got the reputations. They don't want to be tossed out. I would have a, I'm a little more concerned about some of the smaller companies, and there are a lot of small companies that are running around the shales.
If I recall, didn't Jimmy Carter, when he was president, want us to use shale for our energy source?
He was, I'm trying to think, I'm guessing he was probably talking about shale oil. You know, just to keep things really confusing, for years out here in Colorado, they talked about developing this shale oil, which they were going to basically bake underground for a couple of years and to turn this gooey stuff into a liquid that it can go. That's not really the shale we're talking about right now.
Okay.
Yeah, it's real.
It does get confusing.
The industry talks about shale oil and oil shale. I mean, come on. If you couldn't confuse people more if you tried.
Let's go to Daniel in San Antonio, Texas. Hey, you're on the air with us, Daniel. Go ahead.
Hey, George, how you doing, man? I just wanted to let you know, a lot of guys, we listen to you at work all the time, man. You've gotten us through a lot of long nights.
Super. And, tell them hi for me.
Yeah, I will, buddy. But I wanted to bring up some things that I've also, I know your guest was talking about how fracking has brought up production a lot. But we also drill a lot of wells in South Texas. We do them horizontally now. And that has helped out with production as well. You know, we're not just poking holes straight in the ground anymore. We'll drill down to about 8,000 foot and then gradually kick it off, but we're eventually at 90 degrees.
Wow.
So you got more of the well going through the pay zone nowadays. You know, it's not just one long string anymore.
You must have seen a lot of oil, Daniel, huh?
I tell you what, George, I've been doing this going on almost 13 years now, man, and I've been around the block a few times, so yeah. But I just wanted to bring that point up too. Yes, fracking has done a lot of things for us, but we also, with coil tubing units nowadays, we have the ability to work in an underbalanced environment, which means you can work under pressure. So with that being said, you don't necessarily have to kill the well anymore to do all these completion procedures anymore, and that's less invasive on the formation, you know. So you're constantly flowing the well whenever you're drilling out plugs. And I know your guest is familiar with how fracking goes in stages now. So you might do 15 fracks on one well. And with the coil tubing now, we have these abilities now that are also a big factor in the up in production, I believe.
What do you think of that, Russell?
Makes a great point. You know, we talk about fracking. Really, he's absolutely right. It's two technologies that came together. There's fracking and there's horizontal wells. You know, the ability to drill straight down and then turn the well so it runs through the shale. Because think about it. These rock formations are sort of these 100 or 200 foot thick rocks. And if you drill vertically right through them, you're only touching maybe 100 or 200 feet of the rock. But if you can turn the well and run through it, you can touch for 100 miles. Excuse me, 100 miles. You can touch for a mile through this well. It's really horizontal drilling is critically important.
Did you see the movie There Will Be Blood with Daniel Day-Lewis?
Absolutely.
Great oil movie, wasn't it?
You know, it was. And you know, what's kind of always amazed me, talk about, you know, we see the oil industry so much differently. That movie was based on the old Upton Sinclair book, Oil.
That's right.
And I found the other day one of the early printings of that book, and it was called Oil, A Romance of the Oil Fields. So the same book, you know, 80 years ago when it comes out, was seen as a romance of the oil fields. And when we redo it now, we've got Daniel Day-Lewis as this deranged wildcatter who's, you know, going to drink the milkshakes and just impoverish everyone else. But we really have a different way of looking at the oil industry these days.
Next up, we go to Jeff in Clear Lake, California. Jeffrey, take it away.
Look, I've been an admirer of your show for many years, but I think to some extent you've abandoned some journalistic standards here. You've got a reporter from the Wall Street Journal is basically a PR guy for the oil industry. I think you haven't challenged this guy on the environmental issues. In this part of California, we're very acutely aware of how the oil industry doesn't care about the health consequences of what they're doing. Look at Richmond, California. Repeatedly, they've had accidents, spills, gas leaks. They don't care. I saw gas land. Now, your screener implied that the gas land used actors and it's all a myth. And you know, come on. You know, that's utter nonsense. I think we really need to take a real serious look at the issues raised in Gasland. Now, I'm on their website, and I've noticed they said a couple of things here. They said a couple things like, for example, they point out that the Clean Water Act exempts these wells. Number one, they said, what happens to the wastewater, the 2 to 8 million gallons? Where does the wastewater go? They question that we're even what kind of chemicals are being used. Now, you had people in Gasland that had to leave their home because that they were breathing poison gas, and they had serious, serious health consequences. You can't sell a house under those circumstances. People just had to walk away. You know, and the water problem, water pollution is a big problem. I don't see that there's any objective journalistic standards here for this particular reporter, especially consider who he's writing for. Now, I mean, the alternative media has done some really interesting work here. I wish that you'd tell the other side at some point, George, and look at the industry. They don't care. They don't care who they poison and kill. They just absolutely don't. I know people that have lived just outside of the Benicia a facility, the Benicia oil refinery in the San Francisco Bay Area. I mean, there's some things I'm afraid to talk about right now because I don't want black helicopters flying overhead, but there's some other things I know about.
They're probably already on the air and on the way.
Right, there you go. But
you
but anyway, I just wish you would address these issues because
well,
I have a guest that's not
Jeff,
quite a booster of the industry.
Well, hold on for 2 seconds here, Jeff. Number one, we've been talking about some of the irresponsibilities of the oil companies all night long, and we have done that. We also talked about the dangers and the pollution and why half of the people on this planet are opposed to fracking. And lastly, I'll let you react, Russell, to the allegation that you're a PR person for the industry.
Well, you know, I'm not. I don't get paid by the industry, and if I did want to go work for the industry, I'd get a lot bigger paycheck than I do right now. But you know, there's one thing I do want to. You mentioned when I was listening to you talk about how that water pollution is a big deal. I agree, but I would, as a journalist, you know, I would love to write about water pollution. If there was widespread water pollution going on, I'd love to write about it. You know, I'd win lots of awards. But I've traveled throughout Pennsylvania. I've interviewed regulators. I've talked to people. It's just not that widespread. Considering the amount of drilling and the number of wells, the number of counties, there are a couple instances, and I have gone through and read the paperwork and figured out what's happened. And what I take from it is that when water pollution occurs, it's because you built the wells poorly. And that's one reason I write a lot in the book about a former insider, a former Exxon guy who is making it, you know, he's in his 80s and he's making it his life's work to get people to have better ways to test the well so that before you start fracking, you're sure that the wells are in good shape. I think that's really important. And that's something the industry is not really keen on because it's going to force them to spend more money. But if I were a paid booster, I wouldn't be saying that. But it's something I write about and I talk about, you know, fuck about to anyone.
Russell, if you had a house that had a well and you were in a fracking area, would you protest? What would you do?
Well, you know, I faced this situation, with family members who had property, and they asked me, and I said, look, you should. It's not an easy choice, but if you're going to do it, you should test the water beforehand, have private, independent people come out and test the water. Test the air, make sure you know exactly where you stand. You have the company describe exactly how they're going to make sure that the well is well built and prove that. And that's what's going on right now. There are people who are doing that. There are communities that have local ordinances that require that. I think that's a pretty high level of safety that they're asking for. And it seems to me that's holding up. So I would ask for that. I would ask to make sure the wells are built well and that the water is tested
absolutely beforehand. And the reason for that is, if there's a problem, testing the water is not going to solve it. There's still going to be a problem, but you're not going to end up arguing and in lawsuits for years about, well, how can you prove it? What was the water really like? You would have your evidence. And if you have a company that's building bad wells, that's cutting corners, you know, it would eventually run into problems with regulators and with lawsuits. And
By the way, and I want everyone to know, last October, I had Richard Heinberg on the program talking about how he is opposed to fracking. So what I try to do is balance by bringing on different sides. Might not agree with what you say, Russell, but it's important to hear what you say. And that's what we do. Let's go to Greg in Pennsylvania. Well, no, my gosh, the clock already? I can't believe it. Fast program. Russell, thank you for being on the show. The boom, this has got to be the fastest night I've ever experienced. I'm time traveling. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesour, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, George Knapp, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.